Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show. It's April 1st, 2006. No fooling. It is the show where we have tremendous excitement. Mr. LaRouche himself is traveling in Mexico. Mrs. LaRouche, Helga Zepp LaRouche, is in Germany at a political campaign rally in Berlin. And I'll be the host today, Marcia Mary Baker, for EIR News Service. And I'm very glad that we have the counterintelligence director for the EIR, Jeff Steinberg, right here in the studio with us. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Marsh.
I mentioned people I know you're in close touch with. I think you spoke to Mr. LaRouche this morning. But let me tell everyone the topic, which they may have seen on the website. But this is a humdinger, and it's concerning the military privatization schemes, yes, indeed, the privatization of war or national security, whatever you want to call it, along with privatizing the economy and so forth, these kinds of actions, by a number of key figures, like George Shultz, if you want to think of the Republican side, Felix Rohatyn, if you want to think of the Democratic side. And what Jeff Steinberg has been up to is editing and writing for a sequence of two blockbuster issues of Executive Intelligence Review. One of them is out already, and another one is coming out in the next few days. Part of it's called The Halliburton War, referring to Iraq. And this may be also on the drawing boards for a mass circulation pamphlet as soon and as fast as resources can allow. So because Jeff, in just a very few seconds, will tell you, give you the whole context, give you the focus, and give you the expose, the lowdown, all this. But what I want to say, just two or three things first. One thing is our marching orders for today is are to get this out everywhere and break the whole political situation open here so we can either get out of office outright or otherwise lock up, put in a pen or something, individuals connected with this kind of subversion. And the LaRouche Youth Movement has been leading the charge in Washington, in fact, directly confronting Felix Rohatyn at a meeting earlier on Monday this week. It was March 27th, to be exact, in Washington. And we have an audio tape of that event that during the next 30 minutes or so will play what Rohatyn had to say when confronted. But from Washington, D.C., we have Aaron Smith from the LaRouche Youth Movement. Hi, Aaron. Welcome. Do we have you on?
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Very good. That's Aaron from Washington.
Yes, hello.
And we may also have someone from Boston from the LaRouche Youth Movement.
Yes, this is Matt Ogden.
Oh, Matt, welcome. Very good. So I was just saying what all the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing, and let's highlight one thing that you may hear more about next week, if not sooner. At this very hour, out in Los Angeles, the LaRouche Youth Movement in the Democratic Party, that is especially the newly formed Franklin Delano Roosevelt Legacy Club of the California, of the Democratic Party out there, they're holding a town meeting on the strategic situation, the economy, and what must be done about it. And this simultaneously also in Monterrey in Mexico, there's kind of a South American-wide, electronic media, presentation by Lyndon LaRouche, who's there personally in Monterrey. Jeff may want to say more about this in the next hour. But he's meeting with the LaRouche Youth Movement from throughout Mexico and by hookup to Argentina, Peru, and other places in South America. So, Jeff, what I think we'd like is if you give us the context of why what you're exposing, what are these people up to, this crowd, and as I say, I can, when we go back and forth, make sure that people hear this guy, Felix Rohatyn, in his own words, in his own voice.
Well, I think probably it's necessary first to start out by pointing out something else that I think everyone should have on their radar screen over the immediate days and weeks ahead, which has to do with a seemingly unrelated but not really unrelated matter of urgent policy concern. People have seen over the course of this past week that the situation with Delphi, formerly the parts division of General Motors and GM itself, has reached a kind of a minute-to-midnight showdown, both in court and with the UAW. and there is a very strong likelihood of some combination of the following events. Delphi going into a complete shutdown mode, a UAW strike, which could have completely devastating consequences for what's left of General Motors, the danger of a GM bankruptcy triggering a meltdown of unforeseeable proportions on the derivatives market, particularly the credit derivatives market. And I can tell you that just in the last 24 hours, to put a little spotlight on it, that even though Mr. LaRouche has been warning for over a year that the only way to save the core national security industrial capabilities, machine tool capabilities, among other things, that are embedded in the automobile manufacturing sector, there has to be a major intervention from Washington, a massive emission of federal credits into the auto sector so that these plants can retool to once again expand their overall production beyond just making automobiles, but to, for example, playing a pivotal role in a revival of high-speed rail in this country, something urgently needed. We're on the cusp of a kicking off again of major expansion of nuclear power for a whole bunch of reasons. But we are in a moment now where in the minds of people like Felix Rowatton, George Shultz, and others, this is an opportunity to realize their objective of creating the kind of crisis that will actually bring about the end of the nation-state system and establish under the terms of what's today widely known as globalization, what would amount to a new kind of form of international feudalism in which a small group of private financier interests hold absolute control over the strategic raw material wealth of the planet and are far more powerful on the question of credit and monetary policy than sovereign governments, where, in effect, governments cease to enjoy those things that really define sovereignty. Now, what we're talking about is a transition to offshore synarchist financial institutions owning the strategic raw material wealth of the planet, the manufacturing capacity of the planet, the credit markets, currencies, and under those circumstances, what we're seeing with the proliferation of what are called private military corporations in the Iraq war is the outright privatization of war. And, for example, Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, and I use former in quotation marks because he still receives at least $150,000 a year in deferred salary payments every year from Halliburton and is sitting on something in the range of $18 million in stock options. But Halliburton alone, between the start of the Afghanistan military operation in the late part of 2001 and June of 2004, got $11.6 billion in taxpayers' money to carry out various functions that used to be the functions of uniformed military. And Cheney himself, in fact, was the person who started the whole stampede for the privatization of certain military functions. Now, Felix Rowatton, who has been one of the leading synarchist bankers advocating this idea that in today's globalized world, power resides with private bankers and not with sovereign governments. At his Middlebury College in Vermont, in October of 2004, Rowatton sponsored and participated in a conference on the subject of the privatization of national security. And in his own remarks at that conference, which we've published excerpts from in the EIR this week, he said flat out that as far as he's concerned, the only thing that governments have any claim of monopoly on versus private entities was killing people, and that every other aspect of warfare, the logistics, the support functions, the administrative functions, ought to be handled by the private sector because they can do it better and cheaper, and also because people can speculate on the stock market values of the companies providing these services. So what we're talking about, as one of the speakers at this conference emphasized, is a new form of feudalism modeled on the British East India Company, which was a royally chartered private joint stock company that throughout the 18th and 19th centuries had a larger and more modern army than the British Crown itself had. So that's what we're looking at. Under globalization, a neo-feudalist order in which a private financial oligarchy not only controls credit and controls natural resources and manufacturing and agriculture, but they have their own private armies. And this is what Kissinger and others referred to when they talked about the post-Westphalia system. And with the Iraq invasion and with the bringing in of massive numbers of private contractors, soldiers of fortune, security guards, private engineering outfits, we've set the precedent for something which, if it's not reversed, will be an absolute catastrophe for all of humanity.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And I want to remind people that Jeff's write-up of this, and also Mr. LaRouche's himself, under the title Private Armies, Captive People, I mean, in other words, this present-day thrust towards the British East India Company style model, which we fought a revolution against, is the already in print. It's on the website for Executive Intelligence Review. That's LaRouchePub.com. I'll give that again later. And let me ask you one thing more on this, Jeff. Then we have another 40 minutes to go back and forth on it. But the forthcoming side of things, in an article called Halliburton's War, I think, referring to Iraq, is you review a number of exposés and books, and you put it together that the very continuation of the warfare and the occupation of Iraq since 2003, when things could have been we got in there, it could have been calmed down, that this was perpetuated in order to make rip-off profits, like you just said. Is that right?
Right. Well, I think that was one of the driving motives. They wanted to set this precedent for the privatization of the war. Obviously, among some circles, there was the desire to establish a permanent military presence in the middle of the Persian Gulf oil patch for purposes of global controls on the flow of energy. There's no avoiding the fact that, for starters, the Iraq war was unwarranted, unjust, and by its very nature, a crime. We've had censure hearings in the Senate on Friday, the 31st of March, over the actions of this administration. Well over 50% of Americans polled in recent surveys said that if Bush and Cheney lied to get us into the Iraq war, they should be impeached for that. So, for starters, there was no justification for the preemptive invasion of Iraq. That having been said, in the immediate aftermath of the occupation of Baghdad and the end of what would be called the hot phase of combat. Moves were made using standard and traditional methods by the U.S. occupation force in Iraq to prepare the way for a rapid exit from the country. And you had top people from the Central Command working with Iraqi military officers, with former diplomats from the Iraqi government, and putting together a game plan to immediately stand up three full divisions of an interim Iraqi army to be largely drawn from the existing units of the army that had basically been in existence under Saddam Hussein, but were not by any means necessarily loyalists to Saddam Hussein. They were part of a military institution of a sovereign country. And so General Abi Zaid, General Jay Garner, who headed up the post-war reconstruction and was a retired army general, and others as well, were working on a game plan in which the U.S. military forces would have begun a systematic withdrawal during 2003 and would have turned over security functions to an Iraqi army that would have been maintained intact. What happened instead is that at a critical moment, Vice President Dick Cheney, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, pulled off a coup. They changed the command and they changed the mission in Iraq. They sent in a guy named Paul Bremer, a protege of George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, who was a close friend of Rumsfeld, and who was sent in there with two orders. Number one, de-Ba'athify the country. Fire everybody who had even a remote association with the Ba'ath Party from any government job. And number two, completely decommission and dismantle the Iraqi military and start from square one, rebuilding a new military force from the bottom up, a process that was guaranteed to take many years. We had a chance to get out of Iraq with at least a certain degree of honor and leaving the country far more stable than it is today. And Cheney and Rumsfeld intervened in May of 2003 to make sure that didn't happen and that instead the military occupation by the U.S. and Britain primarily was prolonged, extended, and they knew at that time that the U.S. no longer had the military resources to run such an occupation and that military people, out of sheer frustration and pragmatism, not out of some philosophical commitment to feudalism, would accept the idea that a lot of the military functions have to be outsourced to the private sector. Since we got into Iraq, $300 billion in taxpayers' money has gone to the Pentagon and has then in turn been passed on to what are called PMCs, private military companies, to carry out a lot of the work that should have been previously done by military police, by the Army Corps of Engineers, by other kinds of military units. Now, remember, when he was Secretary of Defense under George Bush Sr., Dick Cheney presided over the largest takedown of the U.S. military since the end of World War II. When Cheney came in as Secretary of Defense, we had 18 full Army divisions. When he left office, we had 10. During that period, he also hired Halliburton, paid them at least $8.9 million to do a secret study, still to this day classified, on how to privatize military functions. And of course, a year or two later when he left office, he turned around and walked across the street and became the CEO of Halliburton. So this idea of privatizing and outsourcing the military on the model of the British East India Company has been a Cheney policy for at least the last 15 years. So Iraq is the big test case, the big precedent-setting case for the privatization of all of these military functions. And companies led by Halliburton have been sucking the government and taxpayers dry. The Pentagon's own audits have confirmed, as of this past week, a report put out by Congressman Henry Waxman, that Halliburton, on average, has overbilled taxpayers in the federal government by 25% on every contract they've gotten in Iraq. And in some cases, on individual contracts, the profiteering has been much higher.
Wow. So, in fact, Jeff, while you were speaking about this, James from California sent an email. He said another expression you could use is privatizing the apocalypse if we let this kind of stuff go through, that the scale of it is so horrendous. So I think
absolutely that, right. That's a very appropriate term.
And, in fact, let's do this. What you're saying about this whole model, British East India companies, literally that kind of thing, let's go, if that's all right, to the what happened when Felix Roatan personally was confronted with these kinds of revelations and the record. Because you're giving a record that isn't secret, but nobody's been putting it together
that's
this
right.
way. And so let me just tell you, let me just say this. Our in our studio, we'll be queuing up the audio clip that we have from Monday night, or from Monday, March 27th in Washington, D.C., while Erin Smith, who's in the LaRouche Youth Movement team in Washington, D.C., she's been all over the place this week, I think, on Capitol Hill and in the college campuses, but her colleagues were at this event of about 70 people, maybe 20 or 30, she can say, were from the LaRouche Youth Movement. And let me say what the event is, and then, Erin, you can describe the questioners of from that were the LaRouche Youth Movement put, the questions that they put that kind of turned the place upside down, and then we'll play the last question where you hear Felix Roatan himself responding, and you get an idea what he's like. But this event we're talking about, you can look for yourself and see it at the following website, csis.org. That's csis.org, and that's a think tank called the Strategic or the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And their particular topic wasn't on, per se, globalization, fascism, or the British East India Company, but because naturally it's not explicit. They had the topic of the national, well, they have an idea of critical infrastructure, National Infrastructure Commission, NIC, that Felix Roatan proposed a year and a half ago, in which his proposal he's been writing about and pushing in the Democratic Party is, okay, we need infrastructure, so we'll have banker investment in it and have build it that way. So what transpired at this event, it was hosted by the president of CSIS, a guy called John Henry, and also present were former Senator Warren Rudman, also Senator Chris Dodd, and some others. But the people who questioned what was going on, Erin, why don't you describe what happened?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Hello, can you hear me?
Just fine, thanks.
Oh, okay. First, I wanted to start off by saying that some of the people that I've talked to here in Washington, contacts and sort of table regulars on the street, are very excited about this Los Angeles development with DFDR Legacy Club.
Oh, the meeting today and so forth.
But just the forming of the club in and of itself, people are very excited.
That's great.
Here in Washington. So I just had to let that be known, at least from the people that I've spoken with. The event with Felix Roatan on Monday, it started out, the questions among the LIM started out with a question from Saba Puella. And I don't know if that's going to be covered on the clip, but he sort of just opened up Roatan's relationship to the Lazar banking family, and also his, you know, his thoughts on improvisation of various aspects of the U.S. economy, which, you know, kind of sort of opened up the sort of floodgates, as you can say. Mr. Roatan didn't respond to that one. And then after that, there was a question, if I remember the order correctly, by another Lynn member, Vicki Overling. And then the last one, which was really dynamic, before it led into the one I guess you're queuing up right now, was a question by a Lynn member named Nico, who actually sort of gave a brief synopsis of this conference that Roatan had with Schultz up in Middlebury College, and just sort of laid on the table what happened at the conference and the way that they were viewing this thing around the privatization of the military. And from there, you know, you got, you know, some freakouts from the gentleman hosting the event. This isn't about the military. This isn't political. This is about infrastructure and these sort of things. So the whole room was very polarized. And for people who will be able to see the footage, you'll see that there was definitely a LaRouche presence that dominated the room so much that even the people from the panel had to say, look, we obviously know that there are LaRouche supporters here and LaRouche's views, you know, we don't agree and things like this. But the whole environment was totally polarized.
Right. Well, then let's go ahead. You'll hear Paul Gallagher, and many of you know him from this show and otherwise, who's over 50. Let me put it that way. He isn't in his 20s. And I think, as Aaron said, the person chairing the meeting was trying to find a non-LaRouche person. So they went with someone who had gray hair. Turns out to be the economics editor of EIR News Service. So you'll hear Paul Gallagher, and then you'll hear Felix Roatan reply. Go right ahead.
Let me put the question from Lyndon LaRouche a different way. What about the model of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, which gave us most of the durable infrastructure that we have in this country now, which was based on the method of which was large public credits issued from the federal government, large public spending, not private investments in order to get the Reconstruction Finance Corporation going and build the TVA, but large public credits. Today we know in the order of trillions of dollars. Is that what you're proposing?
By the way, we're all with LaRouche, so
No, we have a lot of new financing mechanisms since the days of the New Deal. And Roosevelt did marvelous things because he had no alternatives with respect to financing these projects. We do. We have the private sector. We have state and local governments. We have pension funds. We can create special purpose bonds. Some of it may come directly from the budget, but that is the question we can only look at when we know what projects we're going to finance and how much it's going to cost and what kind of revenues they're going to produce. But we are far away from the days of the RFC where there was no other alternative to do this.
Okay, Jeff and Aaron and Matt Ogden, this is the guy the false friendly or whatever you want to call it. Let's call it a lot of names in a second. I have to mention a station break, and then, Jeff, you can say more about this. But our program announcements that we have to make at this particular time just include this fact. The LaRouche Show is weekly on www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com, and I urge you to call in during the week inside the United States. You can have a toll-free number. It's 1-888-347-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. Because this may be hot now, but it's really getting hotter. Right, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm struck by the fact that the fundamental premise that Roatan took off from is such a transparent lie. The idea that in the 1930s that you didn't have bond markets and brokerage houses and all of this array of mechanisms, and that Roosevelt chose the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and state credit because nothing else was available, is a humongous lie. The fact is that Franklin Roosevelt was in a total war with Wall Street the same Wall Street that Rowatton represents. Back in the 1930s, Lazard Brothers, Rowatton was not yet affiliated with the company. He was, you know, basically a kid at the time. But Lazard Brothers was at the center of the financing of the international synarchy, including the Vichy Nazi alliance in France. So the issue is misrepresented. Rowatton, in more honest moments, usually behind closed doors when bankers get together to discuss these kinds of issues, he's let his hatred of what Roosevelt did and what Roosevelt represented to be well known. He said, look, in 1944 at Bretton Woods, governments were the dominant force in the world. And so when Roosevelt created Bretton Woods system, he did so based on the idea that governments more or less had a monopoly on the issuance of credit. Well, now the private sector has a virtual monopoly on the issuance of credit because private central banks have crippled the sovereign authority of governments over credit and monetary policy, and because you've got offshore, completely unregulated pools of money that are multiplied many times over through completely unregulated derivatives markets and the other legacies of the Greenspan tenure at the Fed. So what's being proposed by Rowatton is an international synarchist agenda. What Roosevelt took up was a revival of the Hamiltonian idea of state sovereign control over credit and monetary policy. And that issue is as relevant today as it was in the 1930s and as it was when the founding fathers created this constitutional republic, because their own experience during the revolution was that to rely on private capital was to commit suicide. So it's very, very useful that Rowatton was forced to respond to Paul Gallagher's question. And even though everything he said was a lie, it's a lie that really betrays the actual differences. Now, you know, I mean, there are proposals that are floating around Congress that Mr. LaRouche is comfortable with that would create certain kinds of bonding authority mechanisms and things like that.
Like for rail or something? You mean regional rail? Yeah.
Exactly. There's various things that you can do that will emit bonds into the private sector. But Rowatton is proposing a private banker's dictatorship and an assumption of the sovereign authority that under our Constitution rests exclusively with the Congress and the executive branch.
Right. Well, let's throw it open to anyone. We still have 25 minutes. Any emails, we'll be glad to put to Jeff, Matt, or Aaron. But to Matt and Aaron, Aaron, you raised the mood of people when some of them have been following what you're doing in LaRouche, to hear about the LaRouche Youth Movement and the Democratic Party in California. But do you want to ask any questions? I'll start with Matt, or make any observations about either the organizing on this front or questions to Jeff on these networks.
Yeah, I do. This is Matt Ogden in Boston. I just wanted to report that in a follow-up to this intervention that Aaron reported on at the National Press Club on Monday, we took 11 members of the LaRouche Youth Movement up to Middlebury, Vermont last Thursday to the very college that Jeff Steinberg was reporting on just now, about where Roe Hatton was present at this question of the privatization of the military. We published an expose on this in the EIR. We went to the Middlebury College, and first thing in the morning we got there and walked straight into the Roe Hatton Center for International Affairs at Middlebury and found ourselves face-to-face with Alison Stanger, who is the co-author of the article that we quote at the end of Jeff's EIR article, where Roe Hatton talks about, or Alison Stanger, whoever actually wrote it, talks about the privatization of the military and the model of the British East India Company. So she found herself face-to-face with four members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, young people, telling her that we were there to flush all of the anti-Franklin Roosevelt forces out of the Democratic Party. And then related to her what so we said that we were there to follow up on what Felix Rohatyn said against Franklin Roosevelt. And so she very pathetically said, but Felix loves FDR. Felix doesn't hate FDR. And we reminded her about what Felix Rohatyn had said back in 1998 when he proposed in a counterproposal to what LaRouche was doing, organizing Bill Clinton and Robert Rubin around an issue of a new financial architecture. LaRouche had proposed that we return to Franklin Roosevelt's model of the Bretton Woods system, calling for a new Bretton Woods. And we reminded her, Alison Stanger, that Rohatyn had said, well, I want to have my own form of a new Bretton Woods, but I want to organize it around the interests of the private offshore financier institutions instead of the interests of nation states, because now these supranational private financial institutions have a superior power over nation states. And to that she responded, that's true. This is a completely different time right now. We're in a different world. It's different than FDR. Now we're globalized. So the question I wanted to bring up is having to do with that. We immediately attacked this point and said globalization is not something that was objective. It's not something that you can use now as a premise for a logical argument to say now that there's globalization and now that private financial institutions have more power than nation states, thus we must do this and impose this kind of system. But we attacked it and we said, but the reason there's a globalized world right now is because of the very actions that Rohatyn and his associate George Shultz pulled going back to the 1970s, including when they ran the Pinochet coup against Allende as a sovereign nation state, the head of state of a sovereign nation state in Chile in 1973. So I wanted to ask Jeff to report a little bit more about this, because this is something that Alison Stanger denied. She said Rohatyn had no role in the Pinochet coup in 1973, and his association with George Shultz was something that she denied. Could you go into that a little bit more, Jeff?
Well, sure. Look, let's just take the case of Chile. And there are, volumes upon volumes of material that have been published on the subject. Just to give one example, there is a book called The New Crowd, which is a history of the transition on Wall Street from the old, what used to be referred to as the Our Crowd, largely German emigre, Jewish bankers, who had really kind of played a pivotal role in founding some of the big banks and brokerage houses of the early 20th century. And basically, after the Second World War, you had a new group of people who came into power. And about a third of the book is actually a biography of Felix Rohatyn. And in one of the chapters dealing with Rohatyn, it's a detailed description of the fact that back around the time of the early 1970s, when Salvador Allende of the Chilean Socialist Party was elected president of the country, Rohatyn was the lead outside director of AT&T, the big international telephone and telegraph cartel. And AT&T went absolutely berserk over the prospect of a, quote, socialist government in Chile, and played the pivotal role, along with Henry Kissinger and George Shultz inside the Nixon administration, in pressuring for what became a CIA-executed coup d'etat to overthrow and kill Allende and bring General Augusto Pinochet in as the head of a military junta. Once that action had taken place, Shultz went down there. Other people were sent in from the economics department of the University of Chicago, the so-called Chicago Boys. And Chile became the model for imposing a military dictatorship, a rather brutal military dictatorship, and then turning around and implementing the most radical free trade policies. So any official history, including government hearings of the U.S. government, hearings that took place after the fall of Pinochet down in Chile, good historical archive research, makes it clear that AT&T was the driver behind the Chilean coup against Allende, and that next to Harold Janin, who was the president and CEO of AT&T, the most important executive of the company was the outside director representing Lazard Brothers, Felix Rowan. So, you know, this woman, I think, you know, maybe she's just uninformed, but I think that what you're really dealing with is an attempt to just simply use sophistry to lie and cover up for something that, were it to be widely known among Democrats in particular, this would be poison for Rowett. Rowett has been the gatekeeper for Wall Street within the Democratic Party for decades. And to the extent that Democratic candidates think about their campaigns strictly from the standpoint of how much money do I have to buy overpriced media time, then Rowett functions as a choke point against the genuine return to FDR. Look, we're going to get out the documentation from the Middlebury College conference because the American people right now are completely up in arms. They're disgusted with Bush and Cheney. They're disgusted with what happened with this Iraq war. And they're disgusted with the war profiteering by Halliburton. So by showing that Rowett, along with his friend of the last 30 years, George Shultz, and we know that from people who are intimate with both of them, to the extent that we expose the fact that Rowett is one of the leading Wall Street proponents and architects of this privatization of war and this war profiteering, then this will make him a very unpopular character around the Democratic Party. And that's what we intend to do over the course of the next immediate weeks ahead. So what you guys did up in Middlebury, what you did a day earlier in Washington, D.C., this is paradigmatic of what we intend to do. We're going to also saturate the Democratic Party at the grassroots, first with LaRouche's platform, and secondly, as of this coming week, with a pamphlet, a LaRouche Pack pamphlet, that will contain the contents of these 2 weeks' back-to-back cover stories.
That's great. Matt, do you have any follow-up in particular?
Well, I'll just report that this last EIR that we printed with the intelligence on the privatization of the military, we distributed about 500 copies of that all over the Middlebury campus, plus about 40 bundles of LaRouche's platform.
Yeah. Just to continue that discussion among our work in the population, we've been getting out, I would say, probably a couple of thousand of the new EIR with this said story as the main feature. And one of the things I've found across the board, whether it be on the campuses or out in the population, is that people, and even if people don't understand everything implicitly that goes with that, is really freaked out around this idea of privatizing the military. And the one thing, you know, that just keeps popping up and people just keep saying is like, oh, my goodness, you know, we might have a situation in some of these third world countries where you just, you know, have these band of mercenary armies just going around and killing people. And people are very, very taken aback by that. And I think the one thing we should look at as a historical standpoint is look at some of the ideas that Plato, through Socrates, developed in the Republic around this notion of a guardian of the state. And that people have to look at these ideas very seriously, as Mr. LaRouche has emphasized time and time again, around national sovereignty and what does it mean to actually be a sovereign nation, in our case a sovereign nation state republic. And if we can develop more and more increasingly and highlight and accent pedagogies around this very crucial development that Mr. LaRouche keeps reiterating over and over again as the basis of policy and decision-making from the standpoint of natural law, we could actually get a situation where in no time flat this thing will be totally exposed because it's very white hot right now on the streets.
Oh, that's great. And on this issue of sophistry, Jeff was raising different ways in which at least Rowatton, when he was confronted and the whole thing was shaken up by the LaRouche Youth Movement on March 27th at the National Press Club, at least the differences became clear. But in that speech, I think his opening remarks, he is famous for wild sophistries, one of which he said is that the Big Mac, that's the municipal corporation, the private entity, quasi-private, formed in New York City in the mid-1970s. He praised it, saying this is what we have to do because it shows that you can both provide services but pay back debts at the same time. So if anyone wants to see this this kind of sophistry in action, but that's going to be completely exposed. Again, if you want to, look at csis.org for the March 27th National Press Club event, because I think it's you're going to see the beginning of the end of this being tolerated. Do you think, Jeff, that since we need an emergency infrastructure building intervention for reasons that you laid out right at the beginning of today's hour about the complete crisis in the auto industrial sector, that you see more potential for Rohatyn to be the pariah that he should be?
Well, I think that the issue that's going to sink him is this privatization of war question. And I think the other issue that's now on the table very clearly, particularly for members of Congress, there is no way that we're going to save the auto sector and the embedded machine tool capability within that sector without what Mr. LaRouche has called for, namely, a massive emission of government credits to revive our infrastructure. Now, earlier this year, Mr. LaRouche wrote a document which was specifically addressed to problems that have come up repeatedly in our work on Capitol Hill. Even among people, and this is true of Republicans as well as Democrats, who realize that our infrastructure has fallen into total disrepair, who agree that the only way you can save the auto sector is by retooling it to actually ramp up the overall production to do things other than manufacture automobiles, but bring in the high-speed rail, locks and dams, component parts for nuclear power plants, you name it. What they say is, in frustration, President Bush has built up the biggest federal government deficit probably in the history of our country. And therefore, nobody dares to talk about increasing federal government expenditures. How do we get around that problem? Well, LaRouche wrote this document in which he said you have to separate out a federal capital budget, credits from the federal government, low-interest, long-term credits, for capital improvements in the country's infrastructure. Treat that separately from the operating costs of the federal government, because infrastructure investment that's spent wisely will more than pay for itself and therefore should not be considered as part of the operating debt of the federal government. By this kind of emission of, we're talking here trillions of dollars in new long-term low-interest credits to rebuild the rail system that's been allowed to collapse, to kickstart nuclear energy, to rebuild our water capabilities, rebuild our hospitals, across the board, you name it. by investing in these things, number one, you have a bill of material that has to come from the private sector. You're creating productive jobs in manufacturing and in construction. You're expanding the tax revenue base of the federal government without raising taxes per se. And this is the pathway to building our way out of this current depression that the U.S. economy is in. So I think that because of the shock of what happened on the General Motors and Delphi front at the end of last week, that what we're going to encounter as of Monday on Capitol Hill is an emergency climate in which people will be willing to think the unthinkable and are going to be willing at long last to take these ideas of LaRouche up because they're the only practical solution. And then the issue becomes one of political courage. Will members of Congress have the courage to stand up in the face of a bunch of wild, synarchist bankers, typified by Rowetton, who absolutely are intent on maintaining a private financier dictatorship over the U.S. economy? Look, this Big Mac project that Marcia referenced a little while ago, that Rowetton takes great pride in. He says, I'm the man who saved New York City. Well, what he did under Big Mac, yes, the debts were paid. But how many hospitals were shut? How many schools were shut? How many vital municipal jobs were permanently cut as part of Rowetton's Shaktian austerity approach? The debts must be paid at all costs, and people are going to have to suffer the consequences of giving the bankers their pound of flesh. That is the opposite of Franklin Roosevelt, the opposite of LaRouche, and the opposite of the American system. So we're in a fight with these guys.
Let me ask then, Aaron or Matt. Aaron, you're there in Washington, D.C. Yes. You're probably on Capitol Hill sometime, too.
Yes.
But your sense of people making these crucial differentiations now, or this shock effect of the kind of thing where Delphi management, this crowd, Rowetton crowd says we're going to shut 25 plants down in the country. What's your sense of it?
Well, yeah, I give you my sense of it. Also, I had a question also to ask Jeff.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, actually, while we're still on the topic before we switch topics, I wanted to ask Jeff, what was the type of feedback that you have been receiving on the question of Ms. LaRouche's private army captive people and also some of the work that you've done? What has been a response among retired and current uniform military and I guess it would be like a Pentagon intelligence groupings? What do they actually think about this move of Rowetton and some of the things that you and Mr. LaRouche have been exposing?
Well, it's very interesting because a lot of people went along with the outsourcing of some of these functions for purely pragmatic reasons. In other words, during the period that Cheney was Secretary of Defense, the military was vastly downsized, probably way beyond what should have been done. And so as the result of that, we literally lacked the resources, the human capital, the infrastructure capabilities to carry off an operation like Iran. And remember, Cheney and the neocons, their view was Iraq first, then Syria, then Iran. And so a lot of these military guys just sort of burrowed their heads down and said, we don't like it, but we have no alternative. Therefore, it's the pragmatic thing to do. Outsource certain of these kinds of responsibilities. But presenting them with the big picture, light bulbs started going off. And suddenly they realized that they were being lured down a kind of a slippery slope. When they saw this character, Peter Feaver, who was at the Middlebury Conference, bluntly saying, we are talking about neo-feudalism and the new American empire and reproducing the British East India Company model. At that point, these guys said, no way, that's not for us. That's why John Hamray, who was the host of the Monday event with Rowatton in Washington, in response to Nico's question, basically tried to lie and say that the way that we represented the conference up at Middlebury is not what really happened. Well, I'm very sorry, but we're calling your bluff because the transcript is on the website of Middlebury College Rowatton Institute. The transcript's on the website of the Princeton University Project on National Security. And in case they try to erase it, we've downloaded it already. So we have, word for word, everything that came out of Hamray's mouth, Rowatton's mouth, Peter Fever's mouth, all of the other participants. So, therefore, they can protest all they want. But we would encourage people to read the EIR coverage and then turn around and go back and read the transcript itself. And you tell me if there is one iota of misrepresentation. These guys are lying because suddenly they realize that they're on the defensive. They've been caught in the act of being themselves, and we're putting a public spotlight on it, and it doesn't look good for them because we're doing that.
That's great. And we still have a couple more minutes. We could go back to New England, Matt, in Boston. Do you have more questions or report on the impact that this is already having?
Well, I'll just say something about what Jeff said. He said that the way that we're going to take out the Rowatton influence inside the party is by outflanking it, organizing the lower 80%, the classic Franklin Roosevelt constituency, and that's exactly what. That's exactly what the kind of response that we've gotten from that layer, especially in New England, where you do have a real hardcore sort of former machine toolist specialist kind of working class, and also an agricultural kind of layer that are now being driven either into underpaid positions or complete unemployment. The type of responses that people are giving to the positive solutions that LaRouche lays out in the platform is phenomenal. And people, whatever people think, they know that a youth movement, which is organizing around what LaRouche is proposing in terms of these 50-year development projects, they know that that's the future. They know that there's nothing else in the Democratic Party that represents anything like that sort of positive solution. So even in Boston, it's very significant. Intervening into different Democratic Party meetings and out on the street and things like that. But even in Middlebury itself, I was very amused by the fact that this woman, Alison Stanger, thinks she's on top of the world inside the Rohatyn Center for International Studies. But right outside of her doorstep, right in the Middlebury itself, the lower 80% town with a shut-down granite quarry and a marble works that's not functioning anymore, you have a lower 80% that's out there, and the response was amazing. The response was the same kind of response that we get whenever we organize out front with LaRouche's positive economic solutions. So right outside their doorstep, we were stealing the Democratic Party back to what it is, and going somewhere where Felix Rohatyn has absolutely no access at all. A forgotten man.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid that the time has run out, and we are definitely going to be continuing this in upcoming weeks on this show, but of course on the streets and out organizing. And April 8th will be the next The LaRouche Show. You know, we're weekly from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States on www.larouchepub.com. And also, it should be known, Aaron, you may even want to say something about it, but a good friend of ours, right, Lakeisha Rogers. Do you want to say what she's just declared for in Texas?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Keisha is apparently the chair of the Texas Democrats Step Down. And so this week, Lakeisha Rogers made an announcement that she would be running for that position.
Great. And I'm afraid the time has totally run out. So that's the LaRouche Youth Movement, and the election will be soon, right, Aaron, for the Democratic Party of Texas chairman?
Yes.
June.
In June. All right. Maybe we can get her on next week on April 8th. But be sure and listen. Harley Schlanger, the Western States Representative, and Mr. LaRouche will be here. And thank you all. This is Marcia Mary Baker, April 8th. Thank you, Jeff, Matt, and Aaron. And
thank you.
And goodbye till next time.
Goodbye.